Welcome to Season 3, Episode 30 of the Indotechno Podcast. I'm Alan Hellowell, venture partner at leading early stage Indonesian VC, AC Ventures, and founder of startup consultancy Gizmo Advisors. Now, those at all involved in any aspect of Southeast Asia and Indonesia's technology ecosystem will agree that there is one perennially reliable resource in this space, and that is the annual Economy C report by Google, Temasek, and Bain. Today, we once again have the opportunity to review the findings of the just-released report on all things internet in Southeast Asia, now in its seventh annual edition, with three of its lead authors, Stephanie Davis of Google, Fak Wai Hong of Temasek, and Florian Hoppe of Bain. And what a difference a year makes. Just looking at the region's listed tech companies, C Limited stock prices down an astounding 86%, and Grab shares are off 67% since the last annual Economy C report. These data points from the public markets are admittedly amongst the most alarming. The private realm, meanwhile, shows more mixed data points. VC firms closed 23 funds in the first 6 months of this year, raising $3.03 billion. The figure is a record, surpassing the total raise for all of 2021. Startups receiving VC funding in Southeast Asia, however, witnessed a 20% sequential decline in funding deal volumes in the second quarter of the year. In times like this, I can think of no better authority to confer with than those who have unrivaled breadth and depth of insight into the region's technology ecosystem. Great to welcome you back, Stephanie and Florian, and pleasure to have you join us this year, Wai Hong.
Wonderful to join you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Alan.
Great to be on, Alan. Thank you.
Again, thanks for joining. Now, part of the legitimacy of the Economy C report lies in what each of your three organizations brings to bear in crystallizing the analysis and forecasting the report is known for. Google and its near ubiquity across all things internet, and specifically the insights that Google Trends offers. Temasek, as one of the region's leading investors, and management consulting firm Bain & Company in its advisory work for countless companies across the tech spectrum. I would like to ask each of you, what has changed most dramatically from each of your perspectives? Stephanie, maybe I can start with you. Were there any specific warning signs that maybe presaged today's more challenged environment?
I don't think that this is unique to myself or anything that Google would particularly have insight on, but the old adage of what goes up must come down seems to be playing out here in particular areas of the digital economy. Now, what I mean by that more specifically is not necessarily the stock price declines that you've referred to in the opening, but more around what we would see with adoption of the digital economy and some of the sectors. After just blistering acceleration during the pandemic, we knew that there would be a slowdown, but we must keep an eye on the fact that it's still quite healthy. The second quick thing, though, I say is that looking from a vantage point at Google, where we work with a lot of different e-commerce companies around the globe, we have seen this movement over time from acquisition to deeper engagement as a business model. So that was something that we knew would come to Southeast Asia eventually, but perhaps it's been accelerated with some of these macro headwinds.
Fascinating dichotomy between acquisition and engagement. Now, Wai Hong, what warning signs were you seeing across the Temasek portfolio and the broader tech landscape?
Thanks, Alan. I think from a macro perspective, 2021 certainly was quite a bull year and characterized by ample liquidity, low interest rates, and resultingly high valuations. And it's always difficult to call tops and bottoms of cycles, but the reality of business cycles is universal and enduring. And, you know, similar to Stephanie's adage, I just throw in the only constant that we have is change. And 2022 certainly has seen a meaningful change with supply chain disruptions, rising inflation, and the compression of discretionary incomes, along with rising interest rates to tame some of that inflation. As a result, we've seen sharp corrections in the public markets that you've alluded to at the beginning of your introduction, and technology stocks certainly no exception to that. The point I'd like to make is that this is not really a Southeast Asia-specific dynamic, but one that is global. The decline is correlated certainly to a slowdown in the IPO market around the world. For example, in the US, IPO volumes are down more than 90% in the first 9 months of this year, and really at pretty much 20-year lows. And with that backdrop, as well as the current rate environment, what we're seeing is certainly our investors and ourselves as well pivot away from a growth at all cost strategy and begin looking for companies with paths to profitabilities and heading towards free cash flows.
Makes tremendous sense there. Florian, Wai-Hung rightly emphasizes that much of what we're seeing is indeed not Southeast Asia or Indonesia specific, but relates to global trends. How do you think of 2022 from the perspective of a leading management consulting firm?
So good question, Alan. Obviously, to truly predict 2022, the way it's played out, we really needed an actual crystal ball with some of the macro things that affected us, the Russian-Ukraine crisis and war, the continued lockdown of China and the tensions around Taiwan. The one that was predictable probably were supply chain strains and the resetting of what is called the stay at home and resetting supply chains around that into 2022. I think what we're seeing now is a world where thinking about corporate clients, I actually started to think much more around resilience that was really already visible during COVID and has only been extended after that. I think supply chains continue to be under significant strain. Southeast Asia obviously is the net beneficiary of that. And we're seeing a fair amount of activity on that front, which also actually net is beneficial to the digital economy of Southeast Asia because it does drive further economic uplift in Southeast Asia. In general, we've also been surprised by how well Southeast Asia has held up. While I get to see some of what my global colleagues are doing, Southeast Asia in general, we appear to be relatively far away from a real recession. The economies here are relatively sturdier than some of the other markets around the world. And in particular, Indonesia and Malaysia, obviously, as commodity exporting countries, show relatively healthy trajectories, but also carries with the rest of the region then.
So we can take some consolation in the fact that Southeast Asia is, unlike a lot of other parts of the world, avoiding the real brunt of this economic downturn. Now, one of the more prominent transitions, though, that I noticed in this year's report was that the pace of new internet users in the region more than halved from its pace of growth in 2021 of 10% to 4% this year. This clearly is somewhat attributable to gyrations from the pandemic, but what are some of the other less obvious drivers that might be behind this deceleration in new internet user growth?
Happy to jump in here, Ellen. So it would be the pandemic almost entirely. And this wasn't a big surprise for us. As you mentioned, it has slowed down, but we've added 100 million people to the internet in the last 3 years alone. So it was 40 million each year 2 years ago and 20 million this year. As mentioned, that's a slowdown from 10% to 4%. So there isn't anything that we can identify that's happening outside of the acceleration that we saw during the pandemic. And we see this really a return to normalization and don't expect really any more steep climbs of adoption, bar any unforeseen circumstances, at least in the near midterm. We're now at 77% internet penetration. And at that figure, we're using straight line number of those who have a connection divided by total population. And so is there a little more headroom? Sure, in places, suburbia, but more so in rural areas. But that 4% growth really picks up on what we expect in terms of moderated increases year on year from this point forward.
Thanks a lot for that color, Stephanie. The report also covers that duality that I painted in my introductory remarks, that the public markets have effectively collapsed, while what we call the early stages in the report are actually flourishing by and large. Can these two somewhat divergent trends continue? And how do we expect these trends to relate to each other over the next year or two?
Yeah, Alan, that's a really interesting question. To be honest, more than a dichotomy, I actually see it as a little bit of a trichotomy. You're absolutely correct that we have seen valuations correct meaningfully in the public markets with technology names down 60 to 80% from their highs. And I've already talked about the IPO market. You know, in our report, while we see the overall private market funding in Southeast Asia remaining robust in the first half of the year, it's also clear that late stage private fundings have started seeing some pullback with deal values declining roughly 40%, while early and growth stage deals remaining or exceeding all-time highs. So looking at investor sentiment going forward, I think our survey data that we've collected indicates that 3 in 4 investors see valuations declining by at least 10 to 30% this year compared to the peaks last year, and 1 in 2 expect further declines after 2022 with recovery only expected in 2024 onwards. Now, the good news is that there remains significant dry powder in the region from Southeast Asia based funds, roughly $15 billion at the end of 21. And the region is also attracting additional capital with a number of single family offices based in Singapore growing from 400 in 2020 to 700 in 2021. And we're also seeing an influx of not just US and European investors to the region, but also other Asian investors looking to diversify out of their home countries. So despite some of the headwinds and cautiousness in the near term, we firmly believe that companies that are solving real pain points in the market and building sustainable business models will continue to attract investor interest and capital.
And did I hear you, Wai Hung, that the number of family offices in Singapore rose from 400 in 2020 to 700 in 2021?
That's absolutely right, Alan.
That is incredible. We would see that kind of tectonic change over the span of a decade, but leave it to Singapore to create the incentive systems and infrastructure to make that happen in no less than 12 months. That's stunning. Now, the report very interesting reveals that the majority of digital players, actually, as Stephanie, I think, phrased it earlier in our discussion, are shifting priorities from new customer acquisition to deeper engagement with existing customers. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, sure. As we discussed, 100 million coming online for the first time in the last 3 years alone. And at the same time, the digital economy players were earning to acquire those customers onto their platforms. So that's been the biggest focus. And what we see now across the region is really high adoption, particularly in e-commerce. So we have about 94% of those in urban and suburban areas telling us that they have used or made a purchase on an e-commerce platform in Southeast Asia. This next phase that we see is actually quite natural. Again, we've seen it in other e-commerce and digital economy players around the globe, but it's perhaps here a little bit faster than anticipated. And that is that pivot to profitability. And that typically comes not from acquisition or acquiring users for the first time, but deeper engagement. So a couple of examples, and Alan, you would know these quite well, actually. If we come back to e-commerce and we see in the retail space or non-grocery space, in other more developed e-commerce platforms or digital economies, we see upwards of 30%. As an example, in China, of purchases happening online, retail purchases happening online. Here, it's still less than 10%. If we look at grocery as an example, it's about 10% of total grocery sales are online in the US. We look here, it maxes out in any one of our countries at 5%. So that headroom that exists in this next wave of growth in Southeast Asia is in engagement. And that'll come in the forms of higher frequency of purchases. It could come in the form of average order value. We still see it being quite low in Southeast Asia, $10 to $15 basket size. And then there's also, we see in more developed or mature e-commerce platforms, memberships, streaming and shopping, et cetera. So more to build out these platforms and not focusing as much as they have historically on acquisition. The good news, again, though, is that they have a high user base. A lot of customers have come on board. And so now with these macroeconomic headwinds blowing, they at least have the customer base to be able to build out the deeper engagement that's needed for profitability and longer-term growth.
Those are fascinating comments, facts, and figures regarding e-commerce, Stephanie. I think we're all well advised to keep in mind that despite whatever deceleration we've seen this year, Southeast Asian retail penetration online is ultimately still closer to 10% and far below the 30% plus levels that you referenced in China. And e-commerce indeed represents such a big part of Southeast Asia's internet economy. The report reveals that sharp slowdown in GMV or gross merchandise value from 50% to 16% this year. And the headlines have, broadly speaking, not been particularly encouraging, with, for instance, regional leader Shopee laying off hundreds, if not thousands, of employees, and food and grocery delivery businesses retrenching and restructuring almost across the board. What should we be paying attention to if we descend from this broader meta trend?
Yeah, I think the first thing that we need to perhaps hone in on is that 16% year on year in e-commerce actually being in more positive light than is being painted. And what I mean by that is we're coming off extraordinarily high growth in e-commerce in terms of GMV growth during the pandemic. We know that those tailwinds were there and for the obvious reasons. But the 16% is quite impressive, particularly when you consider the fact that we have returned to mobility across Southeast Asia and even returned to mobility within retail spaces. So if we look at those who are visiting shopping malls, restaurants, movie theaters, we see that in Southeast Asia, they are at least the same levels pre-pandemic. And in most cases, they're actually out and about even more than they were pre-pandemic. So when you see that 16% growth in e-commerce, it's particularly impressive when we know that everyone's back in physical spaces. So a lot of those online habits are here to stay. These are adoptions that people made during the pandemic. And again, it comes back to that healthy space. Now, when you mention some of the layoffs that are happening across the region, I certainly do not in any way want to detract from that being a difficult decision and difficult thing that's happening, particularly to those who may find themselves at the moment out of a job. But if we think about the hiring that has happened in the tech space, including digital economy players across Southeast Asia, it was against a very accelerated path in the last 3 years. So a bit of this is much more about level setting or right setting to go forward, and perhaps not as doom and gloom in the overall digital economy picture as one may see at first brush stroke.
Points very well taken. Now, we mentioned that digital financial services, or DFS, are seeing clear shifts in battlegrounds that have made the landscape more competitive, and that quote-unquote digibanks compete for mass and unbanked consumers, while established banks fast-track digitalization. Tell us more about this transition and what it means for the big competitors here, and just as important, the existing customers.
Yeah, great question, Alan. I think the race for leadership in digital financial services is in full flight. I would call out actually also the pure play fintech. We've seen a lot of activity with specialized players in lending and wealth management, which have built some truly differentiated propositions. I think what we can expect as customers across the board, so from affluent, mass affluent, all the way down to mass and unbanked, is just high levels of transparency, cheaper fees, and better customer service. At every point in the pyramid, banks have done the jobs differently well, I want to say. So some of the more developed places like Singapore, you've got highly functional banks, in particular in the affluent, mass affluent segment. But there are gaps around what still remains somewhat underbanked in market segments, even in Singapore. And then places like Indonesia, you just have not historically had, for example, great access to retail investment products at competitive fees, or even basic things like bank transfers, which cost a fair amount of charges. Obviously, right now, the headlines are all captured by high interest rates to attract deposits. But I think the real differentiator long-term will be better fees, better customer service, more transparency. And it's actually a very healthy rate. As in competitors, you can see all the banks buck up and improve their digital operations to a significant degree, which will benefit in particular the current bank customers. But the digibanks, I think, will take their fair share of the market as well. A lot of the banking properties in the region across Southeast Asia are at very high growth rates. So this is not exactly a zero-sum game that people like on the same pie. The pie is growing a lot every year. And so we expect a fair amount of success across all players in this ecosystem. In particular, I think the established banks will be playing a strong role in the mass affluent segment. The fintechs, I think, will play across the board in product-specialized areas where they will hopefully extend a bit beyond their current core products. And the digibanks, I think, will capture a lot of the mass and probably underbanked space as well.
Some really interesting color around the asymmetries and disparities of what's going on within Indonesia, where we're talking still about basic access in a market like that, and the rest of the region. Florian, thanks for that. Now, digital financial services indeed does not seem to have seen the same sharp declines in growth that e-commerce has seen this year. Lending loan books, according to the report, are likely to grow 25% this year compared to 29% in 2021, while payments GTV, or gross transaction value, has actually accelerated from 9% year-on-year in 2021 to 14% expected for this year. Can we go so far as to say that digital financial services might boast some of the strongest secular growth potential amongst the major parts of Southeast Asia's digital economy over the next few years?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say, Alan. I think it has to do with one, I think, a very broad appeal, similar to shopping. We all need to deal with financial services products in our day-to-day lives. And I think importantly, the fact that this has historically been a little bit underpenetrated. Payments obviously have gone through a very fast rise over the last year, and COVID has really accelerated this with wallets and other digital payment solutions not having access to a majority of consumer bases across the region. And you can see now with the increasing push on profitability that all the big platforms, but pretty much any player in the ecosystem is going through digital financial services as a bright spot. And everybody's trying to capture share and products there. It's much harder to make money in what remain very narrow e-commerce margins than via adding financial services products to existing products and trying to monetize existing customers with those financial services products.
Got you. So the most eye-catching category amongst our forecasts for this online financial sector is online wealth management. And according to the report, we're expecting growth in investment, which we measure by assets under management or AUM, to accelerate from 15% year-on-year growth over 2021 to a compound annual growth rate or CAGR of 34% through 2025, if I'm not mistaken, an even stronger 42% CAGR between 2025 and 2030. Can you share with us the thinking here?
Fundamentally, this is driven by the existing market that underserved wealth management opportunities in Southeast Asia. In general, what you found historically were propositions that were heavily tailored to the affluent market, where much of the deposits reside. Oftentimes, that meant that other segments had less access to strong wealth management proposition, and online solutions here give a much better opportunity to provide these solutions at competitive fees to a wider base. And so if you take companies like Ajab in Indonesia, which really just opened up for the first time, and we would think investment opportunities to retail investors, or companies like Endowus, Crystal AI, or Stashaway in Singapore, which actually tackled the mass affluent market, which has historically been somewhat underserved by banks in Singapore. They each picked market segments which generally do not have great access to online wealth management, and then provided differentially better solutions. It's also a reflection of the fact that wealth management products in Southeast Asia still attract very high fees, very different levels to what you find in more efficient markets. And that obviously opens an opportunity for arbitrage. So we expect this to grow at high rates, both with focused fintechs, the digibanks, and established financial services players starting to fight back.
Excellent. So we'll look forward to seeing evidence of that over the next couple of years. You have touched upon this briefly in your comments just now, but it was also very encouraging to see that Indonesia's online lending loan book actually accelerated from 57% year-on-year growth in 2021 to what we expect to be 66% this year. What, for instance, are we seeing here?
Yeah, I think great question, Alan. I think this really is a space that's going from strength to strength. And we were a little bit worried about online lending in particular during the early stages of the pandemic, when governments also were getting more restrictive on loans and we were worried about NPLs rising. None of this has come true. And I think part of this is the impressive job that companies like Akulaku or Kredivo have done in Indonesia, building out their loan books at relatively kind of still healthy NPLs and really aggressively growing the market together with the banks, because online lending plus includes both things like BNPL, but also traditional digital lending that the banks are going through. Now, we expect that trajectory very much to continue. There's an increasing and I think healthy focus on regulation in this space. We should not overextend consumer lending, but in general, lending has been proven to be an accelerator of growth for most markets. And we would hope that same will be true for Southeast Asia.
Thanks a lot for those extended comments around online finance, Florian. Now, I wanted to shift to what is largely a new theme in this year's Google Tomasik Bain report, being ESG. Many of our last episodes on the Indotechno podcast have indeed centered around ESG issues, which once again stand for environmental, social, and governance. The report mentions that emissions and resources are the hottest environmental issues, while labor practices in digital equality and inclusion, or DEI, are top of mind social topics. What are the implications for both the founder and the investor of this?
Yeah, great question, Alan. I'm probably telling you no news here, but I think one, carbon matters, two, social matters. And that's actually true for investors and for founders. I think first on carbon, this remains a topic of focus in the region. Now, we, for the first time, sized the carbon footprint of the digital economy. Southeast Asia emissions at about 6 million tons of CO2 right now is not very high, but it is a very visible Conlua interface, and we all deal with it day to day. And there is a lot of opportunities for founders and their companies to help influence that ecosystem, in particular through what is often marketplace models that touch millions of merchants and millions of driver partners. I think on the social side also, there's an important aspect here of helping to uplift the economies in the region. In general, the digital economy has been very beneficial to Southeast Asia. We saw a job creation of 30 million jobs over the last years to the digital economy. These are big numbers. And in general, I think workers that are employed in the digital economy in Southeast Asia are still very positive on this. Now, obviously, this does come with worker regulations that we have to start thinking around. How do we treat them fairly? How do we set the right insurance levels? And how is it managed well? And that becomes, again, important from an investor perspective. If you look at the recent Uber share price reaction to potential regulation of making their drivers employees in the US, you can see where the journey is heading for Southeast Asia. It's so important to stay on top of this. And then last, for founders, I would actually add that this is an exciting space for startups. If you think around topics like energy transition and circularity, some of the companies that I came across recently, which I saw were very interesting, was Octopus in Indonesia, which is a reverse logistics platform for circularity, or a company called Revelo, which focuses on secondhand electronics. So some really interesting business models starting to emerge in this, which open up the opportunities for founders.
And Alan, I'm happy to chime in around the investor perspective on ESG. I'll start with some data points. I did run a quick survey and just to understand how the investor community thinks about ESG. And unsurprisingly, many investors recognize the importance of ESG. At least half the investors we surveyed think that ESG considerations are important in their investment process. And more important, I think really critical. Having said that, most investors are still, however, midstream in their ESG capability building, and only a few of them have implemented a structured framework to assess ESG factors. So I think a lot of the investors are really adopting a pragmatic lens, given that ESG is such a relatively nascent concept for companies in the region. Gaps are seen more as opportunities for investors to work hand in hand with companies to address, and as opposed to being really impediments to a transaction or a deal. You ask the question, what can investors do? I think investors really can increase the focus on ESG during their own due diligence processes. And I think they also can vote with their capital by investing in digital companies that demonstrate strong sustainability standards or show strong commitment towards improving their ESG practices. And once again, it's an ongoing journey, right? So post-investments continue to work hand in hand with portfolio companies to implement sustainability practices as a critical value creation lever.
The times are indeed a changing on the ESG front, particularly in Indonesia and Southeast Asia, clearly. Now, Waihong, if you don't mind shifting gears, we mentioned in the report that deal count in Indonesia was relatively constant, declining from, I think, 349 deals in the first half of 2021 to 302 deals in the first half of this year, but that deal value dipped by around $2 billion year on year as investors prioritized profitability and also contend with valuation concerns around late stage companies. Can you unpack these statements a bit more for us?
Yeah, Alan, let me try and answer that question with some aggregate data. Singapore and Indonesia account for the lion's share of deal value, and I think that the trends should be representative. As we discussed earlier, funding levels for early and growth stage deals have remained at record levels, and this was mainly driven by larger ticket sizes as the deal count decreased roughly 7% year on year. In fact, for growth stage deals, average ticket sizes in particular grew roughly 20% year on year, so much larger transactions. And for late stage deals, the overall deal values declined by about 40%. And of note is the fact that the average ticket sizes fell about 50% year on year. And given that late stage companies generally in that pre-IPO phase, the fact that public market activity and sentiment has corrected undoubtedly has had an impact on late stage valuation and deal sizes as investors adopt a cautious wait and see approach. On your point around profitability, I wanted to spend a minute on the topic as it's an important one. Given everything we've discussed so far, it's clear that growth at all costs is no longer a viable strategy, especially for scaled and more mature businesses. Investment hurdle rates are higher, investors are looking for businesses that can grow sustainably, and finding the right balance and calibrating cost optimization with top-line growth is what all companies will need to work through. Now, where that balance sits obviously will depend on where companies are in their stage of development, but regardless, it will certainly push all of them to be more disciplined around pricing and incentives, forcing them to prioritize strategic initiatives, be more efficient on R&D, and focus on organizational efficiency. And this, I think, at the end of the day, is really healthy and will benefit the tech sector in the long run. The large listed tech companies in the region all understand this dynamic and are universally pivoting in that direction, So I have no doubt that the late stage growth companies are following suit. And when the public market windows open again, they will be fundamentally stronger and more attractive IPO candidates.
Very good point. And I can indeed imagine your discussions with investee companies have shifted significantly since last year in that vein. Now, Florian, maybe a simple question for you. What common themes have emerged in Bain's conversations with its tech clientele in Indonesia and Southeast Asia throughout 2022?
Yeah, I would maybe bucket this in two broad groups, Alan. One is more defensive and one is more offensive. And if I start on the defensive, obviously where Weibung just started, profit focus, do better, has been a big topic of conversation and lots of questions there. And a lot of the activity has been actually relatively classic work, I want to say. So it's less exciting next big thing in tech. It's actually just doing better in internal operations, both in delivering the product, but also in the SG&A, where some of these companies have become over time just fairly bloated, not for lack of trying to be efficient, but at a very high growth rate, it's very hard to set up a highly functioning finance function, for example. And so that's been a big theme we saw across the whole ecosystem. Also a topic on resilience of supply chains, obviously. We saw that with both kind of newer consumer tech and existing tech. How do you ensure supply? How do you kind of actually get products to your customers? So logistics actually has differentially in focus. And then if I take the more forward-looking lens, I think a few very interesting themes starting to emerge. One of them is the working future. I think everyone's been struggling with the idea of how to get employees back in the workplace. What is the right balance of work from home, work from the office? How do you attract and retain employees in this new environment? Now, the next 12 months, which are probably a bit more challenging economically, we'll probably do some share to get back to the office. But at the end of the day, employees are, I think, looking for different things coming out of the pandemic. And we have to adjust to this. That's true for big tech companies as well as small tech companies. And then I would also see forward-looking opportunities. So we are seeing a lot of emerging discussions on M&A. One of the highlights of our reporters that looked at talk to VCs and talk about valuations, they are expecting valuations to come down somewhat this year and next. The more forward-looking tech players are all looking at M&A and where they may be able to extend into verticals that they may not have been as active in the past. And interestingly, obviously, Web3 has been a big theme of discussion now. Very few answers in this space. A lot of this is very early infrastructure stage and rewiring of the internet, but there's not a tech company out there who isn't thinking around what this means for them and how it potentially impacts their business.
Thanks for that, Florian. Now, our 2030 forecast for the Southeast Asian digital economy ranges from $600 billion on the low end to $1 trillion on the high end. What factors would push us to either side of this range?
Yeah, so the range this year, we have really widened. Last year, we shared that we thought the digital economy could be $700 billion to $1 trillion. And that wider range is really taking the macroeconomic headwinds into consideration. There is still a lot of uncertainty in that space. So that hopefully goes without saying. We need to see where that's all going to land. But that to the side, we identified some enablers in the first report, which most all of them, with the exception of talent, has made significant progress over the years, so much so that we've identified 4 new enablers to get us to that $1 trillion mark by 2030. Most of those we've discussed are here in this conversation, the first being profitability. That's going to be the top focus in the digital economy here in Southeast Asia between 2022 and 2023. Again, we think that many, if not most, of the companies are set up for success, but yes, they will be pressure tested over the next couple of years. Second, that Florian discussed was ESG. Consumers are now telling us that this is important to them, and sustainability as a part of their decision-making process is important. 40% say, yes, they want to use sustainability as a guidepost when making a decision. And it's a real opportunity for the digital economy to differentiate itself and to show value creation in the space of ESG. Digital inclusion is the third. So making sure that there is access in suburban areas across Southeast Asia where we know digital penetration, at least in terms of consumption or making purchases of goods and services, is lower, and then the rural areas as well. And then finally, the fourth, which we haven't actually discussed here, is data infrastructure and regulation. it's going to continue to be really important that the telecom operators provide the security and speed of connectivity that is needed. The innovation, 5G, it's already at 30% in Southeast Asia, but as that over time rolls out, will be important for the $1 trillion mark. And also ensuring that governments come together to have consistent policies and regulatory frameworks across the region, particularly as it relates to interoperability. So giving businesses the ability to operate across border in the digital economy, and also for there to be data flow across Southeast Asia. A reduced or a fragmented internet just isn't helpful for value that we know is possible. So those would be the four: path to profitability, ESG, digital inclusion, and data infrastructure and regulation.
Some really clearly articulated drivers, Stephanie. Thanks for that. Now, looking at our favorite jurisdiction, Indonesia, we expect 19% CAGR, or compound annual growth, in Indonesia's digital economy between 22 and 2025, but a far greater 31% CAGR in Vietnam over this period. What is behind this impressive growth, if one of you would be willing to share?
I'm happy to take that, Alan. As we point out in the report, Indonesia remains the largest market and certainly has to have big potential going forward. But Vietnam, as you allude to, does have the highest growth rate projections and also the biggest increase in investor focus going forward. And there are a couple of factors that are driving this. I think number one, growing penetration of new forms of commerce incorporating social media elements are emerging as a dynamic and cost-effective way for businesses to really engage customers across the country. Vietnam also has a high-quality homegrown tech workforce that will continue to drive innovation and entrepreneurial activity within the country. Thirdly, improved logistics infrastructure that facilitates nationwide e-commerce transactions, especially within the agricultural and rural areas in Vietnam. One additional point that you might find interesting, in our report, we also talked about some of the emerging sectors of interest, including Web3. And from one report I saw, Vietnam was the number one country in the world from a crypto adoption perspective this past year. And for your listeners in Indonesia, Indonesia also made the top 20. So all around, lots to be excited about.
I would maybe add, I think at the end of the day, this is also a baseline effect. Indonesia has come a long way. Vietnam, I think, is still a bit more on the starting grid. It's come some ways, but still has to go further than Indonesia. And if you think around also the next wave of growth of Indonesia, it really takes the outdoor of Java, which makes Indonesia a much harder logistical challenge because obviously then it becomes less and less accessible the further out you go into all territories, while Vietnam ultimately is one big homogeneous landmass. I think also from a logistics perspective, it is much easier to access and unlock than next level growth in Indonesia. So we remain very long-term bullish in Indonesia, and 19% on the significant base that Indonesia has built is a lot. But Vietnam really has somewhat different journey ahead here. Also on the back of a wider economy, which is just on fire. I mean, we have seen news earlier this year on Vietnam now outranking China on manufacturing export levels, which was just truly impressive.
Thanks for that follow on. Now, I wanted to wrap up by circling back to an important point that Stephanie made. One of the most prominent themes running through the nearly 110 episodes of the Indotechno podcast has been the dearth of relevantly trained, experienced talent in a place like Indonesia. Were there any new findings that the report has shed around this structural issue?
We did not have a specific spotlight on talent this year, but we do have many interviews with leaders in the digital economy and VC funds as well. And we know that tech remains a crunch, tech talent does. So yes, coming back to 2016 and those enablers, talent is the one that hasn't progressed as significantly. Now, talent or a shortage of tech talent has been an issue globally and for a lot of big tech companies as well, but it has been amplified here in Southeast Asia. But much of that tech talent conversation was around volume of hiring. There was the acceleration of the digital economy and companies trying to hire quite fast. The conversation this year has shifted a bit more to the type of tech talent that is needed. So with these macro headwinds, like the volume or the rate of hiring may not be the same as it has been for the last few years, but you think about the things that investors are really excited about in Web3, healthcare at the top of the list, close to 90% of VCs saying healthcare is something that they intend to focus on more here in Southeast Asia, and software as well. And those emerging sectors are not going to flourish as they have the opportunity to do without specific tech talent. So we're thinking about, of course, your computer scientists are going to be important, analytics is going to be important, machine learning, et cetera. So it remains top of the list, or at least in the top five in talking with these companies. And it's going to continue to be important for universities, governments, and of course, tech companies in the area to come together and offer that training, and something that Google continues to be committed to.
We've indeed had the privilege of discussing in significant detail Google's initiatives on those fronts in previous episodes. Guys, yet another episode, which being so rich in expert insights, will invariably offer me, and I assume our audience, many days, if not several weeks, of material to digest. And I do hope we can do this session again next year for the 2023 installment of the Google Tomasik and Bain Report. Thanks again so much for taking time out of your busy schedules to join us today.
Thank you so much, Alan.
Thanks, Alan.
Thanks for having us, Alan.
You're very welcome. We hope our listeners have enjoyed today's episode. As always, please consider sharing any feedback that you have about the Indo-Technet podcast with us. Terima kasih. Sampai jumpa lagi.